And I would like to introduce Gary, and I want you all to give him a very warm welcome.
Thank you, that's lovely, nice way to start. Hi everybody, my name's Gary, I'm an addict.
Hi Gary.
I've been sitting down there, he gave me the choice, do I stand up or do I sit down? And I'm still not very good with decisions, you know. I grew up in a town near Blackburn. I got clean in Blackpool. I've been living for the last 17 years in London, and every time I show up at a convention and I have to sign in and it asks where you're from, I kind of go into a dilemma, you know. And so I'm, you know, sitting up here, I'm thinking to myself, I just stay put, just sit down, stay put. You're closer to the basic text. You don't have to get up. And then I thought, no, take the plunge, dive in. You know, I've been made really welcome here. I want to thank everybody for that. I want to thank the convention committee for putting this on. And for inviting me to come and speak. You know, a guy who used to sponsor me, he used to say that, you know, that speaking at conventions, he said, Gary, it feeds the part of your personality that should really be starved. And I know exactly what he means by that. You know, that the real heroes at conventions are not the people who get up and give the big talks and the entertaining, funny speakers. It's those people that show up on a Tuesday night in the middle of winter when it's raining and kind of thrash it out in group consciences when they don't feel like doing it to put these things on. You know, we should always acknowledge those people. You know, if you look at our NA symbol and the foundations of what Narcotics Anonymous is, the word service is in there. And, you know, people talk about service like it's optional. And it's been an essential part of what's kept me in this game for as long as I've been here. My clean date is the 13th of September 1993. Home group is a Trafalgar Square Friday night speaker meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. If you're ever in London, please come and see us at 7 o'clock. It's a great meeting. We have a website for that meeting, which is www.naspeakers.co.uk, where you can listen to, you know, some of the old timers, you know, because I got clean in a place where there was, at the time I got clean, in the place I got clean in Blackpool, there was one NA meeting a week. And there was one person in my first meeting who had more than a year clean. And I knew this girl from when I was using, I lived in Manchester for a while when I was using in a housing estate called Hume, and she lived there, she was a prostitute. And I knew her from using, and she'd been clean over a year, and I was just mind blown by that. I remember going to her at the end of the meeting, my first ever meeting with NA, and saying, let me just get this straight. You have been over a year with nothing. Well, not a glass of wine, but a spliff, nothing. Because, you know, nobody had suggested the idea of total abstinence to me when I was using. At the time I was using, the place I was using, there was no Narcotics Anonymous. You know, when I was going down to the community drug team to try and convince them to tell my doctor to give me more methadone, there was no poster on the wall saying Narcotics Anonymous, drug problem, maybe we can help. And you could call a number and speak to somebody who was clean, and you know, they'd send out the 12-step cavalry to bring you to a meeting. It just didn't exist. So we believed all those lies, once a junkie, always a junkie, because that's what we saw happening. People would go off to jail, the day they would come out of jail, they'd be using again. And you know, they'd go off to these weird and wonderful rehabilitation centres that we had back then, where they would try and teach people to socially drink. And You know, and then you'd see them 6 months later back on the street using again, you know. And so it felt hopeless. It felt hopeless. It didn't seem possible that you could live your life without having to use something. It just didn't seem possible. So my enduring memory of my first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous was it was the first place I'd felt welcome in quite a long time. So it's very, very important to me to make people feel welcome when they come to our meetings, just like you guys have made me feel welcome here today. And this is my first time in Copenhagen. I'm pretty shocked at the fellowship in Copenhagen. I've never seen so many muscular addicts. I mean, I don't know what they feed you guys on over here, but I took my top off out there because it was hot, and I started feeling like that guy on the beach who gets the sand kicked in his face, do you know what I mean? And so yeah, you're a pretty beefy bunch. But you know, I've been made to feel really welcome, and that's really special, you know. And I, you know, I had no idea about addiction when I got here. I came into my first meeting. I'm Gary. I'm an addict. I didn't know what I was talking about. I knew a hell of a lot about drugs. I could tell you about prices, and I could tell you about weights, and I could tell you about the chemical composition of tablets and all kinds of useless information that I used to kind of, you know, sit around spouting off when I was using. But I knew absolutely nothing about addiction. And I've only found out about addiction by coming here to Narcotics Anonymous and reading what we've got in these books here, like the basic text and the It Works, How and Why, and you know, and the NA literature that we've got there, the Living Clean and the Step Working Guide. You know, there's a lot of good information in there, and I've had to speak to people who've got more experience than me, and as time's gone on, I've started to piece together a little bit of an understanding of what it is that I suffer from. Because when I was out there using, I had no clue. I had no idea. If you're sitting in this meeting today, regardless of whether you're clean, you're using, however long you're clean, you're blessed. Because the majority of people who've got what we've got don't even get to hear about this. We don't even get to hear about it. You know, my home group is a Trafalgar Square speaker meeting. You know, sometimes we've got 120, 150 addicts in there on a Monday night. But in the greater scheme of the using population of London, you know, it's a drop in the ocean, you know. And so I had no idea, you know, and when I first came to NA, I did that thing that we do in NA, which is I heard what other people were saying and I studied other people. And I just repeated what I heard other people saying. So, you know, for years in NA, I would say, I always felt different as a child. And then, you know, as years went on in recovery, I kind of realised I don't really remember how I felt as a child, in truth. I grew up in a very working class environment. My father worked in a mill. My mother worked on the market. We lived in a two-bedroom, small terraced house in a small northern mill town where it rains a lot. And it was, you know, and I don't... Nobody talked about how they felt. Nobody talked about their emotions. I had no idea how I felt. And I think it was when I got to around the age of 12 years old, I can start to see the cracks. That's where I can start to see the cracks were appearing. And a lot of what I talk about my early teenage years, you know, life is lived forwards, but it's understood backwards. I didn't understand a lot of this stuff at the time it was happening. But, you know, I can see now that around 12 years old, when friends of mine started to hit puberty, you know, I didn't hit puberty until I was nearly 15. So those couple of years there from 12 to 15, you know, I was so inwardly focused. I thought there must be something wrong with me, you know, and I'd go to school and we'd do sports at school and everybody would go into the showers afterwards, and there'd be kids there who've got like hair coming out of their ears and their backs and they're shaving, and I'm this kind of skinny kid who's kind of waiting to start puberty, just kind of thinking, I don't want to go in there with those people, you know. It was like compare and despair, you know. So I started to think that, you know, what's wrong with me, you know, what's going on? Because this is happening to other kids, it's not happening to me. And other kids appeared outwardly far more confident than I felt inwardly, and I was quite intimidated by other kids. And we used to hang around in gangs, you know, and we'd be really cruel to each other. And I kind of grew up on red alert, you know, because, and if we were picking on a kid, then I'd join in, because if we're picking on him, they're not going to pick on me. There was another kid who hung around with our gang called Gary McEwen, and his name was, you know, his nickname became Gary Bald Balls, because he hadn't started puberty, and everybody used to give him such a hard time about it. And I used to join in with it, and I used to think, if these lot find out about me, then I'm in real trouble, you know. So I had this big secret, you know, and I would see the girls in the pool hall, and they were like the untouchables, and I'd want to go over and chat to them, and something inside me would be like, you know, maybe not, maybe not. And, you know, I'd hear another kid tell a joke that I'd find funny, and I'd want to tell the joke, and then something inside me would think, what if they don't laugh, you know. And so there was like a lack of spontaneity. And then one evening, me and two of my friends, we got a bottle of cider, and we left the pool hall, and we went round the back of the garages, and we drank the cider. And it was like exhaling a breath that I'd been waiting my whole life to exhale, because it changed my perception of reality. The kid that left the pool hall was very different to the kid that walked back into that pool hall. All of a sudden, from taking that drink, the kid I'm intimidated by, I'll fight you and I'll fight your friend while I'm at it. The girl I'm too nervous to talk to, I'll go and chat to her. If she's not interested, I'll just chat to her mate. The joke I was too nervous to tell, all of a sudden I'm so much funnier. I was funnier, I was better looking, I was tougher. It just felt better. So of course I wanted to do it again, but you know, I didn't wake up the next morning dogged by a mental obsession and a physical compulsion. I just went back to school on Monday, and then we did it the following weekend. But I remember going to the doctors with my mother and seeing the posters on the wall. In the 1980s in England, we had a big government campaign against heroin. Heroin screws you up. And they'd have these pictures of like guys with bags under their eyes looking gaunt. And I saw the posters and I was just drawn to it. I was fascinated. You know, I remember taking one of the posters and putting it on my bedroom wall. You know, it's like, I don't think that government campaign was designed to have that effect on 14-year-old boys, you know, but it was like, I was fascinated. Before I ever came across a drug, I was fascinated by them. So when the opportunity did arise to use, and the first drug I used was amphetamines, I didn't have to be asked twice. And I cobbled together a personality for myself based on what I saw people around me doing. You know, I was like a pretender, because at the core of my being, I've always felt like a bit of a fraud and a bit of a coward. And so I overcompensated for that, and I tried to pretend I was something that I wasn't. And my using, I remember, you know, what using gave me was a real sense of identity. You know, I knew how to talk, I knew how to walk, I knew where to go, I knew what music to listen to. It was, you know, and it was all about being a part of when I first started doing it. And it very quickly progressed. And it progressed from that to becoming something that it was necessary to do. Now, I crossed an invisible line, and I can't tell you when that happened. But once I crossed that invisible line, using was like a daily thing. You know, it talks in the basic text, it says, we know the two things that make up true addiction, obsession and compulsion. Now, I remember reading that when I was about 6 months clean, and, you know, where I was using, nobody talked about obsession and compulsion. You know, people just wanted to know, how much money have you got, you know, what's going down. It was like, that wasn't language I was familiar with. So I made it my business to find out about that stuff, you know. And obsession is one thought that overrides all other thinking. When I would wake up in the morning, my first waking thought was to get and use and find ways and means to get more. And everything else in my life was a distant second to that. But the thing is, I'm of an obsessive nature. You know, often with me, I'm either obsessed or I'm not interested. And there's very rarely much in between the two. I've got a little bit better as time's gone on, but that tends to be the way I am. You know, I obsessively get into things. But I can work with obsessions. And like I say, I've had all kinds of obsessions in the time I've been clean. The double whammy of addiction is that compulsion. That physical compulsion. A physical urge beyond my mental control. Now, I don't know if any of you relate to this. The only time for me it seemed like a good idea to get clean was whilst I was stoned. Whilst I was stoned, it was the best idea in the world. You know, I would be sitting there, monged out, scratching my nose, telling myself, tomorrow this has got to stop, tomorrow this has got to change. And I would wake up the next morning, obsessed and craving. Physically craving to use. The worst thing about physical craving is that physical compulsion, being compelled to do it. You know, I'd be walking into situations telling myself, I don't want to do this. I don't want to go here. And, you know, it was like, no matter how much of it I got, it was never quite enough. So the only time I was satisfied was when I was unconscious. You know, if I wasn't unconscious, I wasn't quite stoned enough. So I didn't make a very good drug dealer. Don't know if anybody can relate to that. You know, I've met a few kind of villains and Al Pacino types in Narcotics Anonymous, but I wasn't one of them. Because when I got to that stage in my using, you know, I remember I would go and get myself, you know, I'd go and get myself a few grams, and I'd come back with the intention of setting myself up and starting selling again. And back when I was using, we used to have the McDonald's spoons. They used to have these spoons in McDonald's, and the McDonald's spoon was like, that was a £10 bag. And so I would cut all my wraps up, and I would put all my wraps out, and I would start putting all my £10 bags together. And as I'm putting them together, I put my personal over here and I'm putting my wraps together. And I've got that part of the addict personality where I want everybody to like me. So I'm putting these really good bikes together because I want everyone to go away and say, oh, he's got the best bikes. He's got great bikes. You know, so I'm putting these bikes together. I wrap them all up. I put them in the drawer. I start using my personal. Before I know it, I've finished my personal. I sit back and I think, those bikes were a bit big, weren't they? So I go back to the drawer, I get the bags out of the drawer, I start opening them all up and taking a little bit out of every bag so I've got some more personal. I wrap them all back up, I put them back in the drawer and I get back into my next lot personal. Before I know it, the personal's finished. I think to myself, oh, I took a bit too much out of a couple of those bags. Maybe they're a little bit too small to sell now. Maybe I just use a couple of them. I'm back in the drawer again. Before I know it, it's virtually all gone and I'm scratching around with two poxy £10 bags trying to get £20 together so I can get on my feet the next morning. You know, it's like I was never, never satisfied. It never got me quite to where I wanted to be. And the other thing with me was, while all this was going on, I hear some addicts in NA, they say, when I'm out there using, I have no conscience. My problem was, I had too much conscience. For me, my conscience is the voice of my spirit. And I would be going into situations, I'd be in some crack house in the middle of some housing estate in Moss Side, and people would be screaming and there'd be weapons and all kinds of stuff going on around me, and something inside me would be saying, you're not supposed to be here. Your life wasn't supposed to turn out like this. You're really not cut out for this. You're not like these people. But the obsession and the compulsion was so powerful that I couldn't listen to that. So I would just have to keep going and keep using and keep going and keep using. And the other thing was, you know, when I was out there using, no one could tell me anything. I was so egotistical, I was so ruled by ego, that no one could get through to me. And people tried. Family members, girlfriends. Well, you know, people would say, guys who've been using for many years would say to me, you know, you need to slow down with that stuff. You need to just slow down with that stuff. Yeah, whatever. Leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. I'm fine. Get off my back. Gary, you carry on with that stuff. It's going to kill you. Yeah, whatever. Not, you know, I'm not interested in your opinions. Leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. As my addiction progressed and the powerlessness had got heavier and heavier, those moments of clarity where my conscience would cut through all that became more and more frequent. And to the point where, towards the end of my using, I just despised myself. I despised the person that I'd become. And I could not figure out why I could not stop using. Because I had probably 2.5 years of with what I describe as a misguided desire to stop using before I came to my first meeting in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I remember my brother's a straight goer, you know. My brother's a big guy, he's a straight goer. He rings up one day, this was a couple of years before I ended up getting clean, he rings up and says, you know, you're ruining our mother and father, you're ruining their lives. You're just ruining their lives. We're going to get you off that stuff. I'm going to take you on holiday, we're going to detox you, and we're going to get you off that stuff. So I'm sitting there and thinking, oh yeah, maybe I could do with a holiday. I haven't had a holiday for a little while, sounds okay, and I'm not going to argue with my brother. So I say, okay, fine, no problem. Let's do that. So he rings back the next day, he says, I booked it. We're going on a skiing holiday. I was like a skiing holiday to do a detox. I've never been skiing, do you know what I mean? And it was like, so we end up going on this skiing holiday, and I detoxed. I took a little bit of juice with me. I detoxed myself. We were in Colorado. We were thousands of feet above sea level, so I didn't withdraw as badly. I didn't realize that if you're high up in the mountains, you don't suffer as badly. But I got through my detox, and every night I was going to a local bar, drinking. Then I would get back to the apartment where we were staying, smoke some spliffs, feel like I'm, you know, go white, feel like I'm falling down a cliff over and over again, you know, and like feel sick from it, but like I was getting clean. This was my idea of getting clean. So by the end of the holiday, in my book, I'm clean. We get that flight back to Manchester. I go to duty free. I'm in duty free. I think, what can I buy? Jack Daniels. I buy a bottle of Jack Daniels. I get back home. I'm in my bedroom in my mum's house. I wake up the next morning clean. So now I'm going to work out my plan for recovery. So best thing to do is I'll get myself a beaker full of that Jack Daniels while I figure out my plan for recovery. So I go downstairs to get a beaker. My mum's following me into the kitchen because my mum's kind of got to the stage where, you know, anytime I walk in the kitchen, it's like tinfoil alert. You know, it's like, I don't know if any of you ever had that experience, you know, you're in your parents' house and you're trying to rip the tinfoil quietly. I never mastered that one, do you know what I mean? And so I get a beaker of Jack Daniels, I drink the Jack Daniels, and I think, right, here's what I do. I stop hanging around with all those scuzzy junkies, and I start hanging around with all the hooligans who go in the local pub again. That's what I'll do. And for the next 6 months, anytime you saw me in the street, I'd have a tin of Carlsberg Special Brew, or Tennent Super Strength, or White Waste Damson Wine, which is about 14%, but gets you kind of warmed up for the day. And I'm eating atazepam and Valium and Ativan and shooting Dicanol and shooting amphetamine so I can drink more booze and taking ecstasy and sniffing cocaine, and I'm offering guys out for fights who are twice my size, and I'm getting beaten up, and I'm waking up in police cells after blackouts and not knowing what I've done, and all the guys in the pub are saying, you keep it up, Gary, you're doing great, you stay off that shit, you know. And so like by the time I ended up going back onto the powder, it was like a relief. I was worse off it than when I was on it. So I don't get into all that NA drug hierarchy about, you know, I was a junkie, I was a crackhead, I was just a dustbin. Whatever, you know, you put in front of me, I can get myself in a mess with it. So I end up I ended up overdosing, and I woke up in a psychiatric unit, and my mother was there, and my mother she got this information from these people in London called Families Anonymous, who told her to stop giving me money and to stop believing anything I said, and they kind of ruined my union a little bit, those people, and so she got this information, so I wasn't allowed in her house, and she turned up at this psychiatric unit, and I was in this psychiatric unit, and there were people in there who really were mad, like real one flew over the cuckoo's nest sort of people, and I'm there in this bed, and to be honest, I just felt relieved. I felt relieved to be off the street. They were bringing me my medication. They were bringing me my food. The nurses were kind. And I'm in the psychiatric unit. And my mum came to see me, and I begged my mum. I said, "Mum, I've just got to come home. We've got to beat this. We've got to beat this together as a family. We've got to do this together." And so my mum, she kind of, in the end, she gave in and said, "Okay, come back home. You can do a home detox." She picks me up from the hospital. We're not even back at the house, and I'm already negotiating with her. You know, I'm going to need a little piece of hash, I think, because it'll just help me get to sleep at night. And you know, and so I do this home detox. You know, and I get the methadone, and I have to reduce, and it's like a swift reduction of the methadone. And I thought, I'll just do the home detox. So what happened was, I wake up and I go down, and my mum's solution to everything is feeding. So she's putting all this food in front of me, and I can barely eat, you know, and it's raining outside, and I feel depressed, and I'm not sleeping properly, and I'm sweating it out, and I'm reducing the methadone, and I'm trying to get clean, and then I stick to the detox. I get about 4 days into it, and then I think to myself, it's weekend. Yeah. It's Friday. You know, I've been doing really well here. I've kept to my detox all week, so what I should maybe do to reward myself for having done so well is just have a Friday bike. I'll just have that one bike on a Friday. It's not going to do any harm to anybody, you know. So, of course, I sneak out, I have the bike on a Friday, I come back home, I put the TV on in my room, I roll a spliff, I'm watching TV, I think, that's okay. The next day, Saturday, I go back onto my detox. Sunday, I can't stop thinking about the following Friday. Monday, it's like someone slowed the clocks down. It's like, when's Friday coming, you know? Tuesday, it's like, Friday, Friday, Friday. Wednesday, come on, Friday, hurry! Thursday comes, I think, I'm so excited that it's going to be Friday the next day that this week I'm going to have my Friday bike a day early. So I do my Friday bag on the Thursday. So I use my Friday bag on the Thursday. I go back to the house. I put the TV on in my room. I roll a spliff. I wake up the next morning. I open my eyes. My first waking thought is, what day is it? It's Friday. Well, I've got to have a Friday bag because it's a Friday. So I go and I get myself another one. And the next day, Saturday, and the methadone isn't covering me anymore, and I'm feeling sick and I'm feeling uneasy. And then Sunday comes, and I walk down and I see my mum and dad sat there in front of the TV, and I just thought, you know what, if this is life after drugs, you can keep it. I'm gone. And I'm out there, and I'm shoplifting, and I'm robbing, and I'm doing what I have to do, and I'm hanging around on street corners, and I've got 15-year-old kids on mountain bikes talking to me like I'm an asshole because I'm £2 short for a bike yet again, and just all that world. And I was sick of it. I was sick of it, and I hit bottom. And hitting bottom for me, I can sit here now and I can tell you for another half hour all kinds of stories about the stuff I got up to using, but hitting bottom for me was hitting the place where I knew I didn't know best. And I screamed out in desperation to whatever's out there, help me, I can't do this anymore. I can't go on another day living like this. Within 24 hours of doing that, through a series of bizarre circumstances and coincidences, I end up 30 miles up the road in a treatment facility near Blackpool where they detoxed me. And they put us all in a van and they took me to my first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. And you know, and I've been coming ever since. And I've stayed there. here's where it gets really interesting, because what I figured out quickly once I got clean was not only do I have an abnormal reaction to drugs, I have an abnormal reaction to abstinence. Like, the obsession, there's one thought that overrides all others. Yes, the obsession to drugs, that went. The obsession to use went. But it was quickly replaced by my new obsession. An obsession with myself. One thought that overrides all other thinking. I couldn't stop thinking about myself. Constantly. Why do you think I wanted to stay down there? It's like, what do I look like? What do I sound like? These jeans don't look right with these trainers. I need a haircut. I've got bags under my eyes. I've got a spot. This, that. It's like constant barrage of thinking about me. What does that person think of me? Did I offend that person when I said that? And that, and that? Constant. Starts driving you mad. No wonder people go back using drugs, because if you're left with that, it just drives you mad. And that's what happened to me. It started to drive me mad. You know, and we have one NA meeting a week, so we had to go to the Mother Fellowship, who I call all kinds of names for many years, but I don't do that anymore because I grew up. And I grew up in Narcotics Anonymous. And what I realised now was those people in the Mother Fellowship, they suffered me. Because, you know, they would say to us, you know, out of respect for our fellowship, we'd ask that you don't talk about drugs and you don't use that added word. Tell me not to do something, it makes me want to do it about 100 times more. I'm a failed rebel. You know, so what I did, so I'm going into their meetings and I'm deliberately saying things to antagonise all these old Scottish, these old angry Scottish AA guys, you know, and they were frog marching out of meetings, and you know, and I was in conflict with them the whole time. I just, you know, I enjoy drama. I always have done. I love a bit of drama. Do you know what I mean? So I would go in there and create drama, but you know, I'm grateful to those people now because they suffered me and they tolerated me, and you know, through being able to go there, it enabled a small core group of us to start more meetings, and we felt we had a duty and a responsibility to tell as many people as possible about this message, our message. Because where I come from in the north of England, there's a lot of these very working class mill towns. There was no NA in any of them, and they were awash with drugs and addiction. So we went into the prisons and we went into the detox unit, and 22 and a half years later, I still go into the prisons and the detox units. Thank you, thank you. Conventions is really flattering. You don't get up here and showboat about, you know, hey, I've been clean over 22 years. I'll be there on a Monday night. I'll be in the crisis centre in Islington on Monday night. And I'll tell you what, as I'm driving there, I won't feel like doing it. I never do. I never feel like I really want to go and do this. It's the same with all NA service. It never seems like a good idea. But when I actually do it, that's where the rewards are. You know, and I've been blessed that I've had some good teachers in the time I've been clean. You know, my first 18 months of recovery, I just came to meetings. You know, it says in our readings, you know, I was about 11 years clean, I sat in a meeting and somebody read, "We've learned from our group experience, those who keep coming to our meetings regularly stay clean." I went, what? I never heard that before. I've been sitting in meetings for 11 years, and it was the first time I heard it. It's like, from our group experience, it's not a theory. That's what we've seen happen. Come regularly, stay clean. So I've continued to come here regularly, even when I don't feel like it. You know, we talk about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. I think they're in that order very deliberately. Because sometimes I do this unwillingly. But the point is, I do it. You know, and after about 18 months clean, I was going to meetings regularly. You know, my first sponsor was an absolute disaster. They said to me, look for the person who's got what you want. Right, now that's not the best idea, telling a guy like me that when I'm like 5-6 months clean. In the meetings I was going to, this guy turned up. He was from the East End of London. He was a used car dealer. He's what we call like a wide boy, yeah? Every weekend he was out with a different woman. He always had a big wad of cash with a rubber band around it. Every meeting he would show up in a different car. And he said he had 4 years clean. And he said, look for the person who's got what you want. And I thought, well, that's what I want. I don't want to be kind of drinking herbal tea and talking about God. That's what I want. So I said, would you be my sponsor? He said, yeah, of course I'll sponsor you. So he became my sponsor, my first sponsor. He invites me round for dinner at his house for a sponsor-sponsee meal. And back then, you know, we used to get the cassettes of these American speakers, you know, and you'd hear them talking about, you know, they'd be crying on the stage, he's talking about the sponsors. And this guy was like, come round and have a sponsor-sponsee meal. So I go round there, he's cooking these two steaks, and as he's cooking them, he's pouring Carlsberg Special Brew onto it. And he's cooking away, and I'm looking at it, and I said to him, I don't know much about this, but I know what you're doing there is not right. And he was like, no, don't worry about it, all the alcohol boils off. I didn't eat it, and he didn't stay clean. He wasn't clean the whole time he was sponsoring me. But I stayed clean, I believed he was clean, and it kept me clean. You know, and the sad thing is he passed away, a year ago from cancer, but you know, he never got the message. I then watched him for, you know, the next couple of decades, going in and out of jails and in and out of detox units and crisis centres, and you know, until he was, you know, I saw him at the very end of his life. He was, you know, in a hospice, and he passed away last year, you know. And I went to see him when he was on his deathbed, you know, and he said, I'm really glad I can carry the message to you, if only I'd been able to carry it to myself, you know. And so, you know, I was sponsorless then for a while. And by the time I got to about 18 months, 2 years clean, I hit my first bottom in recovery. Now, if anyone's stuck around a little while, you'll know what I'm talking about. You know, when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, we said to newcomers, you've got to surrender, surrender to win. I didn't surrender. My addiction surrendered me. There's a difference. You know, I wasn't sick of drugs. I was sick of everything that came with them, and I knew it was a package deal. I'd worked out that it was a package deal. And I found myself at 18 months clean, having to surrender again. Because I was coming to meetings and I'm sitting in the meetings and I'm just like looking around the room and thinking, I wouldn't even take drugs with these people, never mind recovering with them. You know, and like slowly but surely I was putting myself on the outside. I couldn't even see it was happening. Because that ego that ruled me when I was out there using, where I couldn't be told anything by anybody, had slowly started to rebuild itself from the very first day that I got clean. People say, oh, get clean, stay clean, it gets better. Really? It's not been my experience. I heard a woman put it very well. She said, well, for me it got better, and then it got worse, and then it got real, and then it got different, and then it got real different. You know, and that's how it's been for me. You know, what happened to me, getting physically better, you know, things started to come into my life. I got myself into college, I got myself a girlfriend, all this stuff started to appear. And that's why it was so important that after a few years in here that somebody taught me the importance that rock bottom is not about the external circumstances. It's about hitting that place internally where I know I don't know best and I reach out and ask for help. I've sponsored multimillionaires, I've sponsored people who've come into recovery as multimillionaires. If I make my rock bottom about shoplifting packs of bacon and jars of coffee, they're not going to relate. So, you know, it's about hitting that place of being desperate enough, until in desperation we sought help from each other. Not from those professional people out there. You know, I'm an amateur. I've been clean a while, but I'm still an amateur. But, you know, we've got to learn how to ask for help and to keep asking for help, because my ego wants to use anything it can against me. It will use my material success against me as a way of making me different from you. It will use my clean time as a way of making me different from you. Yeah, what can you tell me? You've only been around 5 minutes. It'll use something as spiritual as the principles of the program to make me different than you. Well, I've got the real recovery. I'm not sick like those people who go to that meeting over there. My ego wants to separate me. It wants to make me superior, or it wants to make me inferior. And the crux of how our program in Narcotics Anonymous works is the power of our identification. One addict to another addict. The therapeutic value of one addict helping another. All I need is that identification. I don't need, you know, the unsolicited advice person that grabs me outside the meeting telling me what I need to do. I'm alright, I don't need that. I just need that identification. More so now than ever. You know, a good friend of mine says, you know, don't tell me the page numbers because I won't read them anyway. You know, and that's not denouncing the literature, but what I'm saying is, I just need to know how it is for you. The last year or so of my recovery has been probably the toughest I've had. I've been married for 10 years, I've got a 9-year-old son, you know, I've had a successful career, and I'm in the middle of a divorce, and we're all, because of the cost of living in London, we're all living in the same house, and it's been a very protracted and drawn out divorce, and my wife is also in the fellowship. And it's been very, very, very difficult. And all I can do within it all, not all I can do, but all I have done within it all, is just come to meetings. I've not wanted to come to meetings. I've not wanted to speak in meetings. I sit in meetings and part of me is like, what are you going to talk about anyway? And if you do talk, your anonymity is going to get broken and it's going to get back to her. And you know, and I'm so bitter around the divorce. I really am. I'm bitter about it. And I spoke to my sponsor, I said, I've got such a burning resentment. He said, of course you have. He said, be bitter for a while. You'll figure this out. He said, right now, go to meetings, do your service, stay in touch, stay close to the people you trust. And in doing that, I can keep my eye above the horizon line in relation to my drink, my use of drugs and drink. I can keep my eye above the horizon line. I can see what's going on. And there's going to be amends that are going to need to be made at some point. There's going to be admittance of where I was wrong. There's going to be all kinds of stuff that's going to go down. But I'm just not there yet. And it's been challenging. But my experience has taught me, show up, put your backside in the chair, switch your phone off. Even though everything, you get those kind of heebie-jeebies that want to switch the phone on and see if I've had any text messages or any updates on social media, switch it off and leave it off until the end of the meeting. And the meetings have been such an important thing for me. We talk about this being a spiritual program. The word spiritual, if you break that word down, has the word ritual in it. For me, coming to meetings is a ritual. The moment silence, the readings, the share, the fellowship, the prayers. There's a ritual there, a ritual, a series of actions performed in a ceremony. It's what we do. There's something takes place in here that I don't get anywhere else. There's an energy in this room right now that I can't cultivate on my own. You know, so I don't want to go anywhere else. I've had a lot of success on society's terms in my recovery. I've been halfway around the world. I've been to World Cup finals in recovery. I've been on tour with bands that I'm a big fan of in recovery. I've done all kinds of stuff that I, you know, just just being here today, it's my first time in Copenhagen. Recovery's brought me here. I wouldn't be in Copenhagen if it wasn't for what I do in Narcotics Anonymous. I've had all kinds of blessings have come into my life as a result of doing this. So I'm staying close to this. I don't want to go anywhere else. It's not. I don't have that ambition that I had in early recovery, which was, my ambition was to be able to get myself into a place where I can do less in order to stay clean. Why do I want to do less? All the best experiences that come in my life come out of doing this. And believe me, I've done all kinds of exciting stuff outside of it. But what I've learned is, if I'm not present, if I'm locked up in here, where the problem lies, you put me amongst who you want, where you want, and it won't make any difference. I'm not there anyway. I'm in here, locked up. You know, and I haven't used in a long, long time. So, you know, drugs aren't the problem. This is the source of the problem. The thinking, the mind. So what I've learned to do is, don't go to the source of my problem for advice on my problem. Bring that stuff to you guys. Bring that stuff here. You know, and I don't know. Such a lot has happened in the time I've been clean. You know, I hit bottom around 2 years. I hit another bottom around 5.5 years. I was walking around raging all the time. So much anger. You know, hoping that people bump into me in the street so I can have an altercation with them and blame them, arguing with bus drivers, being abusive, you know, and then going to meetings and wanting to sit there and talk about spiritual principles. You know, and so around 5.5 years, I did a 90 meetings in 90 days. And, you know, we were talking earlier and I was saying about, you know, with my clean time, in the time I've been clean, it's very easy to become unsurrendered. And the question I sometimes ask my sponsees, I will say to them, if I was to ask you now, would you go to 30 meetings in 30 days? Would you be prepared to do that? And this, you know, the sponsee might be 10 years clean. And it's a good kind of inventory check, because it's like, at 5 months clean, if you say go to 30 meetings in 30 days, I'd have gone to 30 meetings in 30 days. So what's different now? Yeah, all right, my life's a bit fuller. But, you know, I've got to do what I've got to do in order to stay here. Someone told me early on, you've always wanted to be different. Now's your chance. Don't use again, because most people do. If staying clean and helping others is my primary purpose, everything else in my life seems to work itself out. If money becomes my primary purpose, I start to get feared up and I come unstuck. If women and relationships become my primary purpose, I start to get feared up and I become unstuck. If my career becomes my primary purpose, I start to get feared up that I'm going to lose it and I come unstuck. Stay close to this. Doing this allows me to operate within all that other stuff, and I function in that other stuff far, far better than I ever could without this. You know, and what I realised after a number of years clean was that when I first had that first experience, when I was that kid who walked out of that pool hall, who was all insecure, with all full of his secrecy because he was hadn't started his puberty and he was all frightened of everybody and all too nervous and too insecure, and he took that drink and it changed his perception of reality. That's what I've needed in recovery. Something here that will change my perception of reality that's not chemical. Something that will affect me from the neck up that's not chemical. And where do I get that? Well, it's in the steps. The 12 steps talks about having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. The problem is the spiritual awakenings that we get here It takes consistent and persistent effort over time. By nature, I'm impatient and lazy. I want things now, and I want you to do it for me. And so that what I've found here is a connection to something spiritual. And there's something I like to read when I speak at these things, because I was asked to speak at the South African Convention in Durban, which was another crazy NA experience. I ended up staying at this treatment centre in this Zulu village. And you know, you're there and you're like, it's called do-do-do. And you're like, how did I end up here? Do you know what I mean? What brought me here? But I was speaking like this, and I said, in NA we have one promise, freedom from active addiction. And at the end of the convention, this guy came to me. And he said, don't you know about the other NA promises? I said, what other NA promises? It says, you know, I've got one promise, freedom from active addiction. But I need a bit more than freedom from active addiction if I'm going to stay here long term. And in this How It Works, How and Why, in the 11th step, it says that we see that regardless of the presence or absence of material success in our lives, we can be content. We can be happy and fulfilled with or without money, with or without a partner, with or without the approval of others. We've begun to see that God's will for us is the ability to live with dignity, to love ourselves and others, to laugh and to find great joy and beauty in our surroundings. Our most heartfelt longings and dreams for our lives are coming true. These priceless gifts are no longer beyond our reach. They are in fact the very essence of God's will for us. That's the NA promises. That's what we have on offer here. And it comes in the strangest of forms. And it comes through the strangest of people. You know, and it's like, I'm not washing up. Why would I want to wash up for 40 people? Well, try it. See what happens. You know, most of my best relationships in Narcotics Anonymous have been born out of doing service in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, and that feeling, that sense of duty, that sense of unity, pulling together. And don't get me wrong, there's days, you know, I've had quite a lot on my back in the time I've done service. Don't you worry about that, you know. I can tell you those stories as well. But, you know, it's a guy said to me once, he said, you know, they crucified Jesus Christ. They assassinated Gandhi, they shot John Lennon. He said, you know, all the great spiritual leaders get persecuted, so you're in good company. So, you know, and I mean, I just have to keep coming back here. And this is where I want to be. I don't know you people, but I feel the love here. It's been a really nice experience to come here and do this, you know. I feel like I should wrap it up now. I'll tell you a couple more stories before I go. You know, when I say about the steps and the traditions, you know, that some of the best experiences that I've had have come from working the steps. You know, the third step was, you know, I'm having to really work on my third step at the moment because of my divorce. I'm frightened that I'm not going to be able to fulfill the financial obligations that I'm going to have. And you know, and it's very simple. You know, my friend said to me the other week, he was like, Gary, it's really simple. Step three, you either believe everything's going to be all right, or you don't. And if you don't, and you start trying to control and manipulate everything, your life's going to become unmanageable, and you're going to become unhappy. And so, you know, I have to trust that something's taking care of me. As long as I keep doing the right things, then I'm going to be taken care of. I have to trust that. And you know, as another friend of mine said, you know, he said, Gary, if it's a con, it's a good one, because I've never felt better. You know, and so I go with that. But you know, the fourth and fifth step for me was, you know, very much about preparing myself to be better able to bring myself into the now. All my fears, all my fears, all my anxieties, all my worries, all my projections, all comes from the future. All my resentments, all my regrets, all my shame, all my remorse, all my guilt comes from the past. And if I'm in my fears, or I'm in my resentments, or I'm in both, it's very, very difficult to be present right here, right now with you. And what the fourth and fifth step does, it allows me to right-size those things to give me greater clarity so I'm better able to live in the now. And I get into the sixth and seventh step where we, you know, I hear people who, I don't like the word defect. It's like, I don't use the word defect of character. I use the word defense of character. Because that's what they are. You know, I grew up on red alert. I was trying to protect and defend myself the whole time. I was worried people were going to laugh at me. I was worried people were going to beat me up. I was constantly, you know, and I would use my arrogance, or I would use all these defense mechanisms to keep people away. And, you know, and they're so inbuilt in me, you know, and I learned from doing the sixth and seventh step that if I could carry out God's will 100% of the time, I would be God. So what sixth and seventh step did was allowed me to embrace my fallibility, allowed me to embrace my humanness, made me realise that before being an addict, I'm a human being. I'm never going to get it all right all the time. You know, and then the eighth and ninth step, you know, making amends. I mean, I've had such powerful experiences doing that, and, you know, and it's a great way of carrying the message. You know, I remember an amend I made a couple of years ago. Because, you know, as time's gone on in recovery, you know, my first amends list, it was quite small, actually. And then I had that weird thing where I got to a meeting and somebody read step 8 from the basic text, and it talked about the definition of harm. And it talked about, you know, because I was a verbal bully. I used to really, really verbally put people down. I was a smart ass. I was a verbal bully. And you know, and I heard that definition of harm from the basic text, and I went home and my list grew immensely. But I remember, you know, sometimes there's amends that just slip through the net and they pop up. And I'd gone back to visit my mum and dad, and I was driving through my hometown, and I drove past this building where I had an apartment when I was using. And I moved into this apartment, and it must have been like, you know, it was like the Tasmanian devil went through that apartment. You know, I was there for probably 6 weeks or something. By the time I left there, the door had been kicked off the hinges by some guys who'd come round to try and take my drugs from me because I was trying to sell from there. You know, I'd had a couple of fires in there. I don't know if anybody relates to that. You know, I had a few fires when I was using it. The carpet was burnt, and, you know, it's like I destroyed this place. I tried in my, I had one of those artistic moments and decided to try and do a mural on the wall of its newly decorated walls. And, you know, I just left this place. It was a disaster area, you know. And then I drove past her and I thought, oh my God, you know, that landlord, I never made amends to that landlord. And I went to watch my football team. And I bumped into a guy at the football, and I knew his father knew this landlord. So I said to him, the landlord was called Bill. I said, do you think you could find out if you can get me Bill's phone number? And he said, I'll give you my number. So he gives, about 3 months later, I get a message from him saying, I've got Bill's phone number for you. So he gives me Bill's phone number. So then, of course, I sit on the phone number for probably another 9 months before I do anything. And then eventually I get round to picking the phone up and ringing this guy, Bill. So I pick the phone up and I call Bill and I say, hi, Bill. He said, hi, who's this? I said, you probably won't remember me. My name's Gary Aspen. He went, oh, I remember you all right. And And so I proceeded to tell him that I felt that I regretted what had happened and I wanted to make it right with him. And so I arranged to meet him in the north of England. We have what are called working men's clubs. And it's a very macho environment where working men go to drink, you know. And so I arranged to meet him in this working men's club in my hometown. And I went out for some food with my mum and dad first. And I'm having food with my mum and dad. And then the phone goes, and it's him. And he's ringing me because he thinks it's somebody setting up a prank. He thinks it's a prank call, you know what I mean? He says, no, it's me. I'll meet you there at 6 o'clock. I'll see you there. And so I go there, and I give, you know, and I give him the money. And I explain to him that I was a drug addict and that I got clean through Narcotics Anonymous, and that now I go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings regularly. And as part of my recovery process, I need to make this right with him. He was just mind blown that this guy, 20 years later, has tracked him down to give him this. He just could not fathom what was going on. And he's like, let me buy you a drink. And I'm like, no, I don't need a drink. And then he's rushed over to the bar. Drinks on the house, buys drinks for everybody in the bar, you know. And I leave and I jump in the car and I go off to my NA meeting. The next morning, that guy, Bill, would have woken up probably with a bad head and an hangover and thought to himself, what just happened there last night? You know, but in a few years' time, one of his nephews becomes drug addicted, or one of his cousins, or somebody who's a friend of his, or whatever, he'll remember that guy from Narcotics Anonymous who came and made things right. So we never know when we're carrying this message. I spent my entire addiction saying sorry. I said sorry every day to everybody and did exactly the same thing almost immediately afterwards. You know, I had the best intentions, but I was unable to follow through on them. You know, and I don't know what else to say. I think I've gone on for more than long enough. You know, you can probably tell I'm pretty passionate about this, and I'm still enthused about it. I'm as enthused about it as I ever was. You know, regardless of the challenges, regardless of the tough times, you know, I keep coming back here. I keep coming back here. If there's one thing you take away from what I say today, it's keep coming back here. Don't believe the lies that your mind will tell you. If it's telling you you're one of the guys that this will never, one of the ladies that this will never work for, don't believe the lie. We have a power here. We have a power that we can absolutely depend on to stay clean a day at a time. Thanks so much for bearing with me. Thanks to the world. God bless you all. Thank you.